listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Welcome everyone. Here we are again. Everyone is welcome here, of course, no matter what background, gender, beliefs. We meet on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people and we respect their elders past and present. There are some notices because, you know, a lot has been happening behind the scenes. So first I'd like to report on a lecture given at the State Library last Tuesday, which was very successful on every score. There were upwards of 80 people, between 80 and 100 people attending, and the lecture was prepared by a librarian who works for the State Library, Carolyn Spooner, and she presented an excellent presentation on the history of the Unitarian Church in South Australia, focusing mainly on the 19th century, and that was easily enough to fill up most of an hour just by itself. Featuring Catherine Helen Spence, but all of the characters and events around that as well. There was a handout at the event, which is just one small facet of what was discussed. We actually have a copy of that in the foyer, which you may want to pick up just for your amusement on the way out. And I think we might try and arrange for Carolyn Spooner to come here and present on a Sunday morning one day, because her presentation was outstanding. Then other news, we now have a new website. So for those of you who know what the internet is, it's worth having a look. I mean, you may not have visited the Unitarian South Australia website for a while. So since the end of last year, it's been in the making, but obviously we've been relying on an expert to help us put it together. And subcommittee and committee of management are now happy with what is a much more friendly, fresher website. And the whole point is to have a reference point for people who aren't here today to be able to have a look at it and get some sense of what we do, what we're about, so that they might want to be part of it. Now, the other amazing development is that I now, after 9 months or something, have business cards. Yes, yes. I've done them myself in something like our new colour that you'll see on the website. But I will leave a few out in the foyer in case you want to have one for convenience. And I can also give some advance notice that we have confirmed a date for the Catherine Helen Spence Oration 2023. Justice Natalie Charlesworth of the Federal Court of Australia on the 9th of November will be giving that address, that oration. The title she's chosen, Are We Flourishing Yet? And it's a reference to the women's movement and what has resulted from that in terms of work, home. So I'm just mentioning it now to save the date, in other words. It'll be at the University of South Australia City West campus down Hindley Street. There's a hall there, 5:45 p.m. And you'll be hearing more about it, but that's all underway now. We might need a few volunteers in due course to help with publicity and catering for the event, because we thought it would be nice to supply some cheese and wine or something like that. We've handed out some flyers and they have all the details, and that will form the basis for other publicity online. But we have not only an email for queries, but we actually do have a a try booking online process whereby we can get the numbers before the event so we know about catering and that sort of thing. So yes, it will be necessary to book either really by booking online preferably, or if that is too difficult, then email or at least telling Mary very definitely that you're going to be there. And of course, take a flyer. The flyer is not for you. It's to give to someone else who wasn't here. Thank you. I hope you're staying for the concert after this service this morning, 12 to 12:45. Looking forward to that from the Terrace Singers. And thank you, Margaret, for bringing that to us. As usual, moving meditation tomorrow at 2 p.m. here. Wednesday, 9 till 12, Bush Care at Shady Grove. Terrace Singers rehearsal next Thursday at 4. Is not on. They're having a break after the concert. Community Garden next Saturday, 10 to 12. Jenny Warner here has all the details for that. Let us now enter into a space of contemplation and leave our worries behind. We'll go straight to some beautiful prelude music from Robin, from Modest Mussorgsky. As is our custom, we light a candle on this chalice, which has been a symbol of freedom from tyranny in the past. We come together seeking more light in our lives as we become more loving and wiser. And now a poem read by Jenny.
If you know the poem, relax, I'm not reading the whole thing. Just the first 21 lines, because it sets the scene. Mort Arthur. So all day long the noise of battle rolled among the mountains by the winter sea, until King Arthur's table, man by man, had fallen in Lyonesse about their lord, King Arthur. Then, because his wound was deep, the bold Sir Bedivere uplifted him, Sir Bedivere, the last of all his knights, and bore him to a chapel nigh the field, a broken chancel with a broken cross that stood on a dark strait of barren land. On one side lay the ocean, and on one lay a great water, and the moon was full. Then spake King Arthur to Sir Bedivere, "The sequel of today unsoldiers all the goodliest fellowship of famous knights whereof this world holds record. Such a sleep they sleep, the men I loved. I think that we shall never more, at any future time, delight our souls with talk of knightly deeds, walking about the gardens and the halls of Camelot, as in the days that were."
Thank you. The words are beautiful. I think we'll take that as a rehearsal and maybe do it again next week. And now we go to another regular part of our service where we have the opportunity to light a candle and express either a joy in our hearts or a concern that we have for ourselves or others. I will light the first candle to express joy in experiencing that wonderful lecture at the State Library earlier this week, when many people who would never have heard of Unitarianism attended to hear about some of the history and some of the beliefs that people here share. Would anyone else like to? Well, that reading was chosen because there is so much mythology built up around the Knights of the Round Table and their tales of valour and courtly love. So I delved into the topic this week, but I want to start with a question for you about chivalry. I'm going to ask you to speak to the person or the people around you, preferably in groups of three or four, might be more convivial, with these questions. What is chivalry? Is chivalry dead? Should it be? Just discuss that for a moment among yourselves. And yes, there will be a test at the end of it. Let's return to a point of focus. We had about eight little groups forming, so I'm going to quickly go around the room. If you can call out the answer, then I'll repeat it, possibly summarise it, and we'll see how we go. So I'm going around clockwise. I'll start off with the first couple of groups. What is chivalry? So from the front there, what is chivalry?
Well, we came up with it as, say, a code of conduct that was very decorative, but covered a very nasty society indeed. It's full of rape, forced marriage, and the squire of the manor taking advantage of all the virgins in men.
I'll see if I can capture all of that.
Cover up all that stuff.
A code of conduct, largely decorative, covering a world in which there was rape, forced marriage, and squires taking advantage of the virgins of the fiefdom. I think I captured the essence of it. What did we have for that question? What is chivalry in the next group? What did you have? Did you get onto that topic?
System of being polite and opening doors for women and taking care of them.
Very good. So in a way, what I'm hearing, polite, taking care of women, opening doors, courtesies, etc., this in a sense is the modern, perhaps watered down version of what the knights of old were meant to be upholding. Now, what about the question, is chivalry dead? I'll put that to the next group, the one that was up the back. Who would like?
I'd like to say probably that they missed off that one on the head because they didn't really want men to open doors anymore. I mean, that, you know.
So the answer there, feminism said, yes, chivalry is dead, not wanting doors opened, etc. So no special consideration for women from men in that sense. Okay. What about a group at the back there? Another group. Is chivalry dead?
Well, no, it isn't. Because we saw it more in terms of people doing
brave masters that we've had recently. So
very good. Chivalry there in a broader context of acts of bravery and helping others, like in recent floods and fires and so on. So in that sense, not dead, because people are still doing those brave things for others, which is great. Let's try that question again. There was a group in the other corner. Is chivalry dead? So the answer from that group that chivalry is not dead, but again, an expanded concept is brought into it of respect and not necessarily gender-based, that it should be respect for all. It's a very similar question, but let's take the next group coming down. Should it be, should we not have the concept of chivalry? Very good. So a similar answer there. It shouldn't be dead in the sense that there should be the sense of acting with honour and helping others, but not attached to one gender or the other necessarily. And there was another group there too.
I think we agreed, our group, that we have better words now that have replaced something like empathy.
So thank you. The answer from that group is quite similar, that we do want to maintain the values, the concept of helping others, but the old-fashioned concept of chivalry, having a sense of power imbalance, the strong male knight and the weak, defenceless woman, we want to get away from that and have other words like respect, honour, but not necessarily with those old connotations. And what about the group down the front there? Should chivalry be dispensed with?
We landed on kindness, good manners and consideration.
So, thank you. So a similar idea that kindness, good manners, consideration are the key values which can be drawn from the old chivalry.
But it's amazing the number of people who offer to help you into this wheelchair when they see me trying to load and unload it. And sometimes I can't, because I don't really understand what I'm trying to do, but I always make sure I say.
So there's a sense in which where people do see the need of others, for example, being in a wheelchair, that there is still kindness out there. So a lot of us are talking about those broader values, respect, honour, kindness, consideration. Let's explore then how is that different from chivalry. And the exciting part then of the reflections I'll offer today, you can see whether your ideas match what the minister thought about it all. As it comes down to us through Anglo-Norman culture, the word chivalry comes from the old French cheval, meaning horse. It referred to those aristocratic leaders and their retinue of wealthy soldiers who could afford horse, armour and sword. Initially, they were the soldiers in a vast number of small territories, perhaps even a single town, whose purpose was to defend that territory and, whenever possible, to acquire more. As population grew, cities developed in Western Europe, stronger bands of knights defeated others, the feudal system developed, with the king at the head of an army of knights and control over a wide range of territories. The history of military dominance by warrior classes, enhanced by the use of cavalry, actually goes back thousands of years, but I'm focusing on the English heritage, which is the background to our culture here. Incidentally, the word cavalry comes from the Italian for horseman, the equivalent of chevalier in French. As has always been the case, it is the winners who get to write history and literature. The winners, collectively speaking, in this case, were the armed aristocrats who enjoyed stories of noble kings and courageous knights, in other words, them. This is where the hero King Arthur comes into the frame. I was surprised to learn that there were Welsh stories of Arthur as long ago as 600 in the Common Era. In an epic poem titled The Gododin, various heroes are described. One particular hero, excuse my Welsh, Guardor is described in this way. He thrust beyond 300, most bold. He cut down the centre and far wing. He proved worthy, leading noblemen. He gave from his herd steeds for winter. He brought black crows to a fort's wall, though he was not Arthur. So you can see the point here. This bloke, Guardor, does all these heroic things. He can kill lots of the enemy, even able to bring death when they were in their fort, so that black crows would come down and eat the enemy's bodies. All of this, but he wasn't Arthur. So the point of the example is that the poet at that time knew that Arthur was the pinnacle of generosity and heroism, and the audience would know who Arthur was, even though he's not described in the poem. So this is one of several poems which celebrate the resistance of the Britons, the resident population, against the Saxons, who invaded from northern mainland Europe. And at this stage, there are no knights or magic in the story. But the next literary event of significance for Arthur is in 1136, when Welsh author Geoffrey of Monmouth features Arthur in History of the English Kings, another epic tale in which the brave and royal Arthur is assisted by the magician Merlin. Merlin is introduced as a character, perhaps drawing on cultural memory of wise druids who guided the people before being slaughtered by the Romans. Monmouth gives historical credence to the tale by defining Arthur's kingdom as pretty much the present-day Cornwall. Monmouth's history was very popular. In 1155, Robert Wuss translated the history of the English kings into French, and clearly this then was a source for Chrétien de Troyes, who developed a new genre from the material in about 1170. Rather than a celebration of the heroes of the tribe, Chrétien glorified the individual hero, the noble hero who, with courage and the highest ethical standards, would win a beautiful woman and inherit the kingdom. Shortly after that, the news came back from Palestine that the so-called Christian armies had been smashed by the locals defending their homeland. There was to be no European military presence in Palestine for hundreds of years. In about the year 1200, Robert Boron reacted to this shocking defeat by adding a twist to the story. The Grail, which had been served up to Arthur at his court, was rewritten as nothing less than the chalice used by Jesus at the Last Supper before his crucifixion. According to the fiction, this had been located and retrieved from the so-called Holy Land and brought back to Arthur's court. And let's not forget that the historic Arthur, if there was one, lived hundreds of years before the Crusades began. Anyway, let's not spoil the story. It was Boron who also added the tale of the sword stuck in the stone, which only Arthur could extract. Meanwhile, a Bavarian by the name of Wolfram Eschenbach wrote a spin-off romance featuring one of Arthur's knights, Parzival, later to be the subject of Richard Wagner's opera Parsifal. In this version, the Grail becomes a gemstone of great and magical significance. Parsifal's quest is clear. The intriguing point to note is that the knight's adventure becomes a story of spiritual development. Parsifal seeks out the court of King Arthur to train as a knight. He is physically strong, but he's naive. One could say he's a fool. He passes all tests to become a knight and takes to heart the guidance he receives to develop self-control and moderation. He's also advised to be courteous and told, do not be quick to question, although he follows this advice a little too closely. On his knightly adventure, he arrives at the castle of the Grail. His regal host has a mysterious wound, but Parsifal does not ask about it. If he had only asked the question, whom does the Grail serve, or what ails thee, or even, are you okay, in the modern vernacular, all would have been well, but he didn't. So somewhat of a lost soul, he continues on his adventures, wandering and fighting, Eventually, he repents his failures and is given the true meaning of the Grail by a holy man. Finally, he's able to leave behind his reliance on the court of King Arthur to seek love and the more spiritual life. The fighting's not yet over, however. He's confronted by Firefiz, not realizing that his opponent is his own half-brother, the child of an African queen who had an affair with Parsifal's father. In Jungian terms, by the truce with his half-brother, the quester for self-realization has integrated his own shadow. Now, to round off the literary chronology, I just mention Thomas Malory. In 1470, he drew from various English and French sources for Mort d'Arthur, the death of Arthur. Rather than being a novel, it is more like a series of 8 books focusing on different aspects of King Arthur's life. And one of those stories is another Grail quest story. It's from Malory's work that most of our modern accounts of Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table have germinated, including the revival among romantic poets like Tennyson. And now I'll call upon Robin again to play the next piece, May It Be. Thank you, Robin, that was beautiful. So, why the fascination over the centuries with Arthur, Parsifal, and the Knights of the Round Table? By the way, I'm putting up on the screen the original Round Table. You can see it's got a big lettering on the notice board at the back, the Fellowship of the Knights of the Round Table of King Arthur. I presume that's the original, anyway. Well, one of the explanations, I think, lies in the warrior archetype, one of the archetypes described by Carl Jung. Jung proposed that, irrespective of one's particular cultural background, there are various archetypes, including the warrior, which we can relate to because there is a collective unconscious of humanity we can relate to the role model of a man who is strong, courageous, compassionate, and caring. Our boys, our young men, in fact, men of all ages, can understand the paradigm of proving themselves as men. For many, especially those who understand strength in physical terms, the warrior archetype remains a very pervasive aspiration. Of course, there's no reason why people of other genders can't be warriors as well. There is something else in the story, particularly in Parsifal's pursuit of the Grail. Everyone who has embarked upon the spiritual journey can see Parsifal's trajectory to greater self-realization. At the end of the story, the Grail is revealed in the Holy Land with three knights present. There is Parsifal, who starts as a fool and ends as a monk, Bors, the ordinary man, and Galahad, the consistently virtuous knight. They have all been on the quest, and they are all served by the Grail. Salvation is available to all. For those who prefer me to speak on a psychological level, we can look at the chivalric code, the ethical aspirations of those who were knights. There was no single set of rules, actually, but various medieval poems and stories set out the high ethical standards for knights to follow. And here is a limited but typical selection of imperatives for knightly behaviour. These are the good ones. To protect innocent people who cannot protect themselves, to provide for the poor, to refrain from unnecessarily giving offence, to fight for honour and justice, not financial reward, to fight for the welfare of all, to always speak the truth, to finish what you start. Then there was also the matter of respecting the honour of women. The strange thing about the idealisation of women that one sees in the chivalry literature of medieval Western Europe is that at the same time there were many portrayals of the woman as temptress, taking a cue from the church's story of Eve leading Adam astray. It seems male lust was projected onto the female of the species, casting them as the troublemakers. And in this context, the admonition to knights to keep their amorous intentions honourable can be seen as a sincere bid to confine the libido so that all that energy could be directed to military action as directed. At the time of the Crusades, which significantly coincided with the peak of chivalric literature, the ideal of courtly love may have also served a social purpose when thousands of knights went off to adventures in Palestine. Implicitly, knights' wives left at home were not fair game to others. That is to say, adultery and rape were outside the rules of chivalry. Although the ethical aspirations concerning compassion, courage, honesty, and protection of women varied in their expression through the medieval literature, the common threads, the most significant threads perhaps, were duty to one's lord and king and military action on behalf of the nation and the church. And this can be seen as a variation of the imperative, which is carried on right through history, to provide soldiers with motivation to risk their life and limbs. It may have been sufficient simply to have ordered knights to go out and grab land off other people for self-enrichment, but the knights could feel better about it, perhaps, if they were led to believe they were fighting for the king and the good fortune of their nation, while earning a place in some conception of a Christian heaven. We still do it today. We tell our soldiers they are fighting for freedom. You hear that every Anzac Day. But you'll usually find there are resources, or some geopolitical objectives of Australia or its overlord, wherever our soldiers are sent to fight. The great 20th century Will Durant summed up chivalry as follows. Chivalry, beginning in the 10th century, reached its height in the 13th, suffered from the brutality of the Hundred Years' War, shriveled in the merciless hate that divided the English aristocracy in the Wars of the Roses, and died in the theological fury of the religious wars of the 16th century. In conclusion, then, if chivalry is not dead, it is at least largely redundant. Justification of violence in the name of God is now totally unacceptable. We don't need phony nationalism to justify sending our defence forces on international missions to prove our loyalty to our superpower ally. We don't need to train our men to protect an idealised version of weak and defenceless women. The notion of chivalry may have done some good in its day. Maybe it did encourage right thinking and some degree of self-restraint among those who had power in medieval times. But in these days, when we value people equally, irrespective of gender, and the humble worker, the person with a disability, the wealthy industrialist, the prime minister, are all worthy of equal consideration and respect, there is a better approach to human relations. In fact, it is summed up in our first two Unitarian principles. The inherent worth and dignity of every person, and justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. These should be enough of a reminder for us to act courteously and to conduct our relationships, intimate and otherwise, so as to minimise harm and in every word and deed to affirm the dignity and worth of others. And with that, let us have our final piece of music. Thank you. We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitariansa.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitariansa.org.au.